I'm Liz Corey.
And I'm Katie King.
And this is
True Crime New England.
What's up, everybody?
Hello. Welcome back to another episode.
Thank you for joining us. We are, as always, typically, per usual, so happy to have you here, especially today of all days. I mean, I guess not really more than usual, but not less than usual.
Right. Right. We are appreciative that you guys are here. Especially for today, because the case we have today is unsolved.
Oh.
So we really appreciate you guys being here and sticking around, hopefully, to listen to this one, because, yeah, it's unsolved.
What do you think, Katie? Do you think it's easier to talk about cases that are unsolved because of the theories that come with it? Or is it easier to talk about cases that are solved because there's a finality to it?
I think easier emotionally to talk about the cases that are solved, because it's like, okay, we know who did it. They're being punished appropriately and accordingly.
Hopefully.
Hopefully. Yeah. Hopefully. And, you know, at least the family has some degree of closure. It's not like they're ever going to have 100% closure.
Right.
But at least they have some degree of closure and they know who's responsible and they can place blame and there's not all these questions.
Yeah.
But with the unsolved ones, I think it's hard, because if that were my loved one, I would be like already with the unsolved cases, I'm like, I just want to know, looking for updates all the time and hoping for some closure, just like for us.
Right.
Because I'm nosy. Like, I want to know. I want to know the answers.
Right.
But for a family member, I feel like that would drive me absolutely insane not knowing.
I know. I would imagine like every phone call I would be just so anxious and my heart would start racing, like, this could be the phone call.
Mm-hmm.
And it's crazy. And I think you're right. There is definitely an easier aspect in the terms of like the solved cases. You got that piece of the puzzle that you just didn't have before, that corner piece or that part where it's like, okay, that was right over the kitten's eye. And now it's, you know, the kitten's in the basket. It's a pretty picture. But with the unsolved cases, it's like, okay, we have the victim, but we don't have the one who did it, or we do, but we don't have the why, like all this stuff. So I think, you know, part of the insanity that is having a true crime podcast is this blend of the unsolved and the solved, and the cases where there are parts that are solved and known, and then the parts where it's all solved or nothing is known. Like, you've covered a case profile recently where somebody just quite literally vanished. There's nothing known. It's just that he's gone.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, okay, was it criminal? Was it just he walked away and got lost and died? Like, what is the unknown? So there are cases that we cover where it's like the mystery is so great. And by great, I mean like insurmountable in context, not like great as in like, this is great, but like the amount of mystery is so much that it's overwhelming. And to think that, like, that is happening to people where their loved one is gone or missing and they don't have answers, I can't imagine how that feels. That's tough. But I was just thinking of that today. Like, what is easier for us to talk about? Do we find ourselves feeling more relaxed and comfortable telling a solved case versus an unsolved, where we're thinking constantly? Do we provoke more thoughts unsolved? It's just a lot to consider.
Yeah.
I think we've become quite the analytical people since starting this podcast. Right?
I would definitely say so, for sure. Even just with like theories and I don't know, sometimes, and I know we talk about this a lot in the podcast, we can get pretty frustrated with law enforcement, especially where cases that might be solved years later. And it's like, duh.
Right.
Or little things that they might have missed. Like, oh, there's a broken piece of furniture with blood on it at the crime scene.
Right.
And you secured the crime scene. You took everything, or so you say you took everything. Mm-hmm. And the family goes in there to clean out this person's apartment or their home. And they're finding broken, like, pieces of evidence that were left behind. Like, just really frustrating things like that. And so I do think that because of a lot of the stories that we tell, I agree that we are very analytical of like the details.
Oh, absolutely. And I find myself when I'm watching, like the other night I was watching a movie with Elijah. I think it was called Alone. not the survival TV show, but a movie. And it was about a woman who was like traveling and she was stalked by this man. And every step of the way that she was being stalked and then captured and then trying to get away from this, you know, murderer, I was thinking like using my knowledge from all of this true crime investigation and research that we've been doing for the past almost 3 years, I was like, if that were me, knowing what I know about killers or this kind of thing, I would have done this. And I know classically that if, you know, he had got me in his car, I would have touched every surface I could have, because then my fingerprints would have been in there and he would have, no way he would have been able to wipe every, you know, like it gets you thinking and you learn like techniques. I don't know if it makes you more like ready to prepare yourself for an instance like that, but it kind of just adds more perspective to your life and also adds a little bit of empathy for those that you read about and you're like telling these stories, you know, like you have this level of like understanding and sympathy that you just want to, like, the reason why we're telling this is because we want to. And we want to tell these stories for awareness and because we empathize and we want the families to know, like, we're here and we're trying to help just as much as we can.
For sure. Right. And I always feel like, too, like, listening to stories on the news, or there recently have been a couple of women and young girls who have been going on a run or going on a walk or something and were abducted or killed or just really awful things. And I'm like, wow, that could be me.
Absolutely.
That could straight up be me. And mm-hmm. I go for walks all the time and I'm always looking over my shoulder. And just like, I think with us two being women and being young women, we always, I mean, growing up too, just the things that our parents taught us and told us and the world around us, like we have to be so, so, so cautious mm-hmm. because we really can be just a sitting duck at all times.
Oh, yeah.
And I do think that with true crime, it's like you can do everything in the world. Like, you can consume all this true crime and you can be so prepared and you can sleep with an axe next to your bed and you can lock all your doors and get alarm systems and, mm-hmm. you know, walk around like pepper spray and it could still be you.
Absolutely.
You can be the most knowledgeable person in the world. You can be the most not knowledgeable person in the world and it could still be you.
Absolutely.
So I think that too adds a layer of empathy, like, holy shit, mm-hmm. this could be any one of us, any one of our family members, any one of our loved ones, former classmates, coworkers, mm-hmm. like the whole basis of our podcast is true crime in New England. And the fact that people don't usually think of crime happening in New England, and we've been doing this, what, almost 3 years? Mm-hmm. And there very much is crime in New England. And we've covered a whole basis of cases, like all across the board, every single category and subcategory and genre you can think of true crime. And it doesn't even scratch the surface of the cases we have to pull from for episodes.
Right. Absolutely. We really do try and bring home that idea of it will happen anywhere. And that's what every episode, I think, kind of details. It's like, yes, it will happen to you. It can. It absolutely can, whether you're prepared or not. Mm-hmm. It's one of those things, like, who knows? It doesn't even matter if you're prepared or not. Like, you've no way of knowing how it will go. It's just so scary.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, us talking about true crime cases in small town New England, you know, doesn't make us any more prepared than the next guy, but I'd like to think it does a little.
Agreed.
Just right. A little.
And not to make you guys feel like you have to keep your head on a swivel at all times
no.
and like constantly live in a state of fear and anxiety, but I think a healthy level of anxiety and some kind of self-awareness is good. But
sure.
Just because that's what you're supposed to do, hopefully, in all aspects of life, not even just the fact that you could be a victim of true crime.
Right.
But right. Yeah.
Absolutely. And we only talk about this because today we have a case that's a perfect example. And I mean perfect in the way that this is a story of somebody from a small town that it just happened to her. And it's so unfair and so awful. And luckily for her, she has a lot of advocates in her life looking to get her justice. But truly, it was just one of these things where it just happened to her. And all we're trying to do is just get attention for her case, because unfortunately, it is still unsolved. And it has been 44 years now since she was murdered. And that is just a damn shame.
Yeah. Big thank you to the user on Apple Podcasts who wrote us a review and used that review to suggest this case to us.
Yes.
This is only the second other time we have done a case based on a review, but that was a really clever way, I think, of bringing it to our attention. And, you know, we saw that right away and we were like, wow, let's look into this case. And yeah, here we are.
And here we are. So thank you very much. That was very clever. It's a good way to get our attention, that's for sure. If anyone wants to kind of use that route, we accept 5-star reviews only. Just kidding. And without further ado, today we will be covering
the murder of Diane Drake.
My dearest Katie, it would be so sweet and so delicious if you would please entice me with your sources today.
I have a lot of sources to entice you with, so I shall begin.
God bless.
I have information from turnto10.com, Rhode Island Current, Newport Daily News Times 3, Unsolved Mysteries Reddit thread, and a document from Roger Williams University that had a bunch of clippings from the student newspaper called The Quill.
Wonderful. I, too, had several sources today. I used 2 threads from Reddit, the Unresolved Mysteries thread. I used an article from WPRI, an article from Turn to 10. I used an article from Newport Daily News, an article from News from the States. And I used that same collection of articles from The Quill, from the Roger Williams University news articles. All the way back from 1981. Whew. Crazy times that I could not describe to you because I was born in 98. But I'm sure it was crazy.
Diane Drake was born to retired Navy Captain John F. Drake and Francis Drake. John had served as the commander of the naval station on Aquidneck Island. I hope I'm saying that correctly. Diane was one of 9 siblings. She had 6 sisters and 2 brothers, and she was the 3rd youngest.
Ooh,
that is wild. I'm the oldest of 5, and thinking about that, think about 3 or 4 extra siblings. Oh!
I only have a brother. So to me, that is like, oh my God. Sounds like a dream, but that's as someone who just has 1 brother. I'm sure anyone who has more than like 2 siblings is like, trust me, you don't want that. You do not want that. But to me, that sounds really fun. And I think they were all pretty close in age as well.
Yeah, and they were all pretty close with each other.
Yeah.
One of her brothers named Bob and Diane, they would always laugh, like just die laughing at their sisters because they would argue over stealing each other's clothes. Mm. There was always some kind of bickering going on, especially among the girls. But Diane was known as the peacekeeper of the family. And one of her sisters said that later in her teens, she became interested in Buddhism, which makes a lot of sense hearing about how she was always into keeping the peace.
Mm-hmm.
She was described as being very zen, very chill, just like, all right, guys, let's work it out and give her shirt back and you give her skirt back and just very chill.
Sounded like they needed that.
Yeah. The family grew up in Portsmouth, Rhode Island, and Diane was a fabulous role model for her siblings, especially her younger sisters, who really looked up to her. She gave great advice to her siblings, younger and older, and friends, and was described as being giving and compassionate. And one thing that kept coming up in my research and was backed by the photos that I saw of Diane was that she had beautiful, long, strawberry blonde hair.
Mm, I did notice that. She did have very pretty hair. She was a cutie.
I know.
There's like one of the main pictures that's used and circulated is her like yearbook photo from high school. She's such a cutie. She has that like 70s hairstyle, like look on and like just style overall. That's like, this is definitely a girl in the late 70s that if you panned down, she probably would be wearing bell bottoms like 100%. She just had that look.
Mm-hmm.
And it's awesome.
At this time, she was a sophomore at Roger Williams University, which back in the day was Roger Williams College in Rhode Island, of course. And she was an administrative justice major, although several sources I saw said a couple different things. Mm-hmm. One said social justice, one said criminal justice. The one that I saw the most was administrative justice or administration of justice mm-hmm. major. But regardless, her major was like, she was so passionate about it, and it was really about helping people, which was her big thing.
Again, that peace aspect. She grew up being a peacekeeper. It sounds like she just continued that, mm-hmm. which I think is awesome.
She was just 19 years old at the time of this incident.
So young. Now, Diane was living at the time with a woman named Elaine, and they were besties. They were having a great time. They lived together off campus in an apartment, and they just were having a great time. They worked at the same location. It was called the Photo Patio. It was in Middletown, Rhode Island. And listen, there are no really such thing as photo development stores. There are, but like maybe one every 200,000 miles. They're just not, you just don't really do that much anymore. But back then that was a real thing. And so they worked there together and they had classes together. They were always doing stuff together. And according to Elaine, who was interviewed in that Quill newspaper a year later after this incident, she was reporting that her and Diane did everything together. They talked about everything and it really seemed like they were just besties. And that was so sweet. And even their boyfriends liked each other, and like they were always doing things with their boyfriends together and just hanging out, having a good time. And it sounds like they were almost like inseparable.
Yeah.
Which is awesome. Like, it's good to have that kind of relationship when you're in college, because especially when you go somewhere new, it's like you need to have some kind of bond with someone that makes you feel safe. And it sounds like Elaine was that for Diane, which is nice. So on March 21st, 1980, Diane was scheduled to work a shift at the Photo Patio. Now, it was a really crappy day outside. It was rainy. It was windy. It was like storm-like conditions outside. It was just yucky. And that makes sense for March. It really does, because late March, you're getting into those spring showers, that really spring, just in bad, not bad, but like just gloomy weather. So it really checks out, especially in Rhode Island. That's fair. Now, Diane wasn't really feeling great that day. She had actually skipped classes that morning, but she really needed to go to work. At least she felt like she did, because it was payday. And back then, you had to physically go and retrieve your check, which I understand some places still do, but I'd say like a majority of us get direct deposit, which, let me tell you, greatest invention ever. But so she was like, okay, I gotta get to work. I know I feel shitty, blah, 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 but she was going to go and get her paycheck. She had a lot of things going against her that day, though, because she did not have a ride to work. Her car that she had, I guess, did not start well in the rain. Typical for back then, I guess. I feel like cars just didn't work ever back then. And Elaine, who normally would drive her to work or drive with her to work, was in class, so she wasn't going to drive her to work. Her ride fell through, essentially, so she just was like, I don't know what to do. Diane's boyfriend's mom even offered to drive Diane to work, but she didn't really want to be a bother, so she was like, no, it's okay. I will just walk to work, which I think is, you know, like, I totally get that. Like, I don't want to be a bother either. Like, totally fair. And I feel bad for her because she was already feeling kind of shitty. And just walking in the cold rain is going to make her feel even worse. So she probably felt like crap.
Mm-hmm.
But she wanted her paycheck, and I do not blame her. So she just opted to work. And according to Elaine, this was the first time Diane had ever walked to work before. Ever. So this one random decision changed and ended her life and changed the lives of those around her as well. So between 2:15 and 2:20 that rainy March afternoon, Diane set out to walk to work. There are a few anonymous witnesses that later report seeing Diane walking in the rain, and police would later officially report they believe she was hitchhiking, but Diane's family and friends, especially Elaine would absolutely deny this claim and say that she was careful and did not like the idea of hitchhiking. I think, you know, back then, 70s was really when hitchhiking was like huge. 80s was when it was starting to be like, okay, hitchhiking's not super safe, guys. Like, maybe don't do it. 90s was like, do not hitchhike. So it was, you know, 1980. So people were just kind of getting into the whole, okay, hitchhiking's, you know, Ted Bundy had just been busted, or he was about to be busted. You know, it was just like not great. People were understanding the dangers. And Diane, according to her friends and family, knew the dangers. And she did not want to hitchhike. Ever.
Right. And she even told her sisters, younger and older, do not hitchhike. It's stupid. It's not safe. You don't know who you're getting in the car with. Mm-hmm. Call me. Call anybody. Call my boyfriend. Call Elaine. Like, we'll all look out for you. Mm-hmm. Do not hitchhike.
Yeah.
And so her family's like, what are you talking about? She was hitchhiking. There's no way in hell. Like, it could be a blizzard. And this girl would not be hitchhiking.
Yeah. And that's the thing, too, is the police were like, well, it was stormy outside. Maybe she just got frustrated. She didn't feel well. And she gave up and was like, well, it is rainy outside. I'm cold. And she stuck out her thumb. Maybe. But I believe her family on this one. She wasn't that kind of girl. And if she was that smart to warn her family and her sisters, you know, about not hitchhiking, I bet you she did not stick out her thumb.
Right. And the walk was 3 miles, which... it could be a lot longer in my head before I heard that it was 3 miles. I was like, wow, that's really,
that's long.
That must be a long walk. And 3 miles, yeah, that's longer than I would like to walk in a storm. But she also was pretty desperate. She's like, I'm a 19-year-old broke college student.
Yeah.
I'm getting my paycheck. I'd rather be at home on the couch. I'm getting my paycheck. But I'm sure if someone she knew pulled over and was like, hey, Diane, where are you headed? And she's like, oh, I'm headed to work. Can you give me a ride the rest of the way? That's not outside the realm of possibility at all.
Yeah.
But as far as we know, she was seen by multiple people walking en route to work.
Absolutely. In fact, the last time she was observed by a witness was around 2:30 p.m. in the Aquidneck Ave and Valley Road area. And unfortunately, this was the last time she would be seen alive, as Diane never made it to work to pick up her paycheck. And after Diane didn't show up to work, phone calls began to come in to Elaine at their shared apartment, which of course made Elaine very nervous. And I think that's totally fair. Calls to her parents' house were made with no luck of locating her, and also this caused extreme concern. And it wasn't long before Elaine, Diane's boyfriend, and other friends from college, as well as her family, were searching throughout the town for her. And it was just chaos. It was cold. It was rainy. It was a stormy, dark evening, damp, yucky, and everyone, I think, just had this bad gut feeling, because where would she have gone? It wouldn't have been like her to just divert her plans. Some people were speculating maybe she had like ducked into a restaurant or a bar to get out of the rain. Like, she just felt so gross because she already had been that day. Maybe she had stopped in somewhere and just, you know, stayed at a restaurant until and was waiting it out, and she didn't have a phone to call or whatever. But as the night kind of went on, it just seemed worse and worse, and everyone was getting real anxious.
On March 22nd at 10:25 a.m., Diane's body was discovered along the waterline on Easton's Beach in Newport, Rhode Island, by two state highway workers who were cleaning up from the storm the previous night. Diane was naked except for her necklace and a watch. Medical examiner determined that her body had been left on the beach between 10 p.m. and midnight the night before. There were no signs of sexual assault, and Diane's body was identified by a close friend of hers at 1:30 that afternoon. The physical damage done to her body by her attacker, the previous night's storm, and the salt water from the ocean made her almost unrecognizable. What was described in these articles was like bloating and discoloration, and just really was not a good scene.
Yeah.
So her close friend had to identify her by her necklace.
Yeah.
Her dad was brought in and asked police if the body was Diane's, and they pointed to a mole she had above her right eye, and John stated, quote, that's my daughter's mole, but that's not my daughter. Her mole and a large scar on her back that she had gotten while swimming were, of course, some of the most identifiable marks on her body, but they were never mentioned in the autopsy report. Mm-hmm. But there were odd little details that the autopsy report did mention, like the fact that she wasn't wearing any fingernail polish, mm-hmm. just little things like that.
Yeah.
But Diane's dad did have a pretty hard time identifying her body just because of the damage that it had sustained from the weather, the storm, her attacker. But it was very, very distressing for her family to see her in that state.
Yeah. Obviously very brutal. And she had been, of course, even in that short amount of time that she had been deceased, salt water does a lot of damage very quickly, storm, and then to think maybe like with the weather, the wind, if she was in the water, to be probably thrown against the rocks or the beach several times, you know, over and over again for a little while, that could cause damage, especially when you're dead. So it was probably very difficult to identify her.
Mm-hmm. Per the autopsy report, Diane, quote, died from strangulation with submersion and blunt force trauma. Abrasions on the left side of the neck are consistent with pressure having been applied to this area, and a fracture of the left hyoid bone is demonstrated, confirming the diagnosis of strangulation.
Mm-hmm.
Investigators believe that there was a possibility that Diane had been tied at the wrists and ankles with a soft fabric object like a scarf. They thought that Diane had been picked up by someone driving by and that the driver was responsible for her murder and that this driver could have possibly been left-handed based on the fact that the blow to her larynx was done in the car.
Yeah.
They weren't sure officially what had happened, but this was their theory that it was likely that the driver was left-handed, which is interesting.
Yeah.
They also said that there was a possibility that due to the blow to the larynx and the nature of the fracture to her hyoid bone around her neck, that she could have been fatally injured in a way that would have taken her up to 6 or 7 hours to die, which is, I think, probably one of the worst things I've ever read.
I think of all the cases we've covered, that was one that I just read and I read and I read over again in all these sources, and I could feel it myself a little bit. Like, it felt like I couldn't catch my breath. And I feel that I'm sure her family and her loved ones who read these articles or like heard this initially after her discovery just would hear this and feel the most amount of pain and feel just awful, because that sounds so terrible. And to imagine a loved one like that is horrific. And I feel so bad for this poor, beautiful girl having to go through this. You hope that they're wrong.
Right.
You can only hope that they're wrong.
There were no injuries or marks on her hands, which means that she either did not or could not fight back, likely because of the blow to her neck, or if she were tied up with a scarf.
Sure.
Several suspects were interviewed and questioned, including Diane's boyfriend, Billy Sears. Her boyfriend was quickly released after questioning, especially when it came to light that she had called him to ask for a ride. But like you said, Liz, his mom answered the phone and she had offered her a ride, but she had declined, you know, not wanting to be a burden or not wanting to, you know, trouble anybody or put anybody out of their way. But it very quickly was determined that Billy Sears was not responsible. In fact, he was out there looking for her and was very concerned. And it happened in quick succession, it seemed like, how, you know, they found her and then her friends are grieving and, oh my God, I can't believe this. And she was naked on the beach. That's awful. And then they're being called to the police station. And in one of the articles on the Quill, the school newspaper, it said that everybody's nerves were just shot.
Yeah.
And then they're being pulled into the police station and then they're being questioned as if they had anything to do with this,
right,
which I understand is protocol, but does not make it any easier for her loved ones,
no,
especially her boyfriend, who was like, oh my God, I wasn't home. I could have offered her a ride and I wasn't home.
Yes.
Like, it's so awful.
Yeah.
One of Diane's sisters had spoken to her earlier that same day when she was last seen at around noon to tell her that one of their other sisters had just given birth to a baby girl. And this was the last known contact she had with her family. Diane's sister, Kathy Coffey, said that she didn't believe that her sister started the walk to work, and she stated, quote, it was such a bad rainy day that she called somebody. She went down the list and called people, and she called the wrong guy. Whether it was an acquaintance or a classmate or whoever, the sister feels like there's no way she would have started to walk to work and that she would have called somebody to come get her.
Yeah.
Maybe she started walking to work, which would make sense because a lot of witnesses saw her walking.
Right.
And then someone came and picked her up and it was just the wrong person.
Right.
But multiple other witnesses had called into the police station their own sightings of Diane walking.
Right.
But not all of these sightings or these statements could be confirmed, mm-hmm. because around the time that Diane was walking to work, it was around 2:15, 2:30 for her 2:30 shift, the nearby high school was getting out at that time.
Yeah.
And there were students, despite the weather being as shitty as it was, there were students that lived close enough or really had no other option but to walk.
Yeah, absolutely.
So the likelihood of there being another teenage girl with long strawberry blonde hair styled in a 70s, 80s fashion was pretty likely.
Sure.
And the YMCA was right around there and people were walking to and from there. And it just is not clear how many of these witnesses saw Diane or how many of them saw another girl. But there are enough witnesses that, yes, we know for a fact that she was walking to work.
Yeah.
Police interviewed two suspects. They interviewed a lot of people.
Yeah.
But two of the suspects they interviewed that they were like, oh, shit, they really could have had something to do with this, were said to have had histories of emotional disorders. So they were seen as, like, not stable or likely that they would have had the capacity to do something like this, but they were eventually released and found to not be involved.
Mm-hmm.
A hair was found in Diane's right hand, and this had been sent down to the FBI lab in DC, but the hair was determined to be her own.
Mm.
They also sent fingernail scrapings to the lab, but they found that no foreign material could be analyzed. There really wasn't anything under there,
yeah.
especially because there were really no marks on her hand. She wasn't able to or did not fight back.
Right.
So that she wasn't able to, like, scratch her perpetrator and get DNA under there. Or, yeah. Like, that really wasn't an option. But I do think it was important that they tried.
I think that's honestly great that they tried.
For sure.
It's a good effort.
Elaine said that in the beginning of the investigation, her and her friends were pretty frustrated with how things were handled. She stated, quote, they would call me up and tell me to get down here right away, and it would only be to look at more mugshots or ask me something they already asked me.
Mm-hmm.
They never really would level with any of us. Once a week, we, meaning parents and friends, would all get together to try and piece together everything they had told us and make sense of it. Elaine also said that she brought someone to the police's attention, or at least she tried to.
Yeah.
She was like, hey, I really think it might be this guy. And they listened to her, and it was about this one local man, and they heard her out after it had already been a week of Diane being murdered.
Yeah.
They ended up clearing this guy a month later, but in the Roger Williams student-run newspaper, Elaine had been interviewed, and she told a fellow peer that she felt as though local politics had a lot to do with that man being released and cleared of any charges.
That's insane to me.
Yes. And the student newspaper, like we keep talking about on here, they had a ton of great information, great interviews. It was students, you know, part of an, I think, investigative journalism class.
Yeah.
And they were really interested in this case. It was one of their peers, like, yeah. they had a really close relationship, and, you know, because they're interviewing peers and they themselves are students, they found that a lot of the people they were interviewing were being a lot more forthcoming with information. You know, people felt more comfortable. The student's approach was very receptive. So they were able to get a lot of information and a lot more, like, intimate information, and people would confide in them with these things.
Yeah.
As opposed to the police being questioned in, like, a dimly lit fluorescent lighting room.
Right.
Where it's really harsh and anxiety inducing.
Yeah.
So the information from the student newspaper was phenomenal.
I feel like Diane's roommate, Elaine, was so integral in this early on part of this investigation, because she was, like, giving out details and, like, trying her best to remember, like, the days before, and, like, oh, I think this guy, like, he was this weird, like, he, you know, this. She was just really trying, and I have a lot of respect for her for because of that. And she, you know, as soon as Diane was discovered and it was all kind of, like, not settled, but, like, the immediate shock went away, she remembered the day before Diane went missing, this incident that happened that normally wouldn't really be a big deal, but it kind of rubbed her the wrong way. So Elaine and Diane, the day before she had disappeared, so this was March 19th, the two of them went to Newport, Rhode Island to get their tarot cards read. Now, this is something that Diane had never really done before, so it was all kind of new, exciting. This kind of reminds me of you and me, Katie, because we've done this before. When we went to Salem 2 years ago now, you and I went to get our tarot cards read, or I got them read, and I had you interpret for me, essentially, because she was, like, doing the thing. She was like, here's the this of that. And I was like, okay, what does that mean? And like, because she would then explain it in like a tarot card reading way. Like, this implies the wisdom of your birth and the this. And I was like, what does that mean? You'd be like, it means you're going to have good luck soon. And I was like, oh, okay. Like, you would do that for me. But so, you know, Elaine took Diane to do this. I don't know if Elaine was regularly into the psychic stuff, but they went and they did this and it was going to be fun and la, la, la. And so when it was Diane's turn in the spotlight for this psychic card reader, they turned grim and cold and offered a very dark and scary reading. And they said, quote, I do not see a future for you. Beware of the man with dark hair. Now, this was one day before she went missing and, well, subsequently was murdered. Was this probably just a scam artist that happened to be, like, really coincidentally a spot on? Probably. But it caused a lot of shivers up people's spines because it ended up being so numbingly accurate. Now, of course, we don't know if the person who killed her had dark hair, but the I do not see a future for you, I mean, within the next 48 hours, she was gone. And that is so eerie. And I'm sure to this day, Elaine is haunted by that because it just was like a silly little tarot card reading turned into this very haunting, very chilling experience that suddenly was true. Like, I would totally believe in tarot cards then.
Right.
I mean, I'd probably be the one that would be dead, but like, it just, it really changes your perspective. And I'm sure it changed hers because holy shit.
Right. Like, what are the odds?
Right. It's crazy.
Marion Galvin, who was a secretary for the Newport Police Department's Criminal Investigation Division, revealed in a later interview that police initially believed that Diane's body had been left in the area of Tuckerman Avenue near the beach, but that her body was washed into the ocean during the storm that night. This is something that was theorized, and there was a lot of back and forth about whether her body was left on the beach, whether it was left in the water, put in the water prior to her death, or was left on the beach, then went in the water, and then washed back up on the beach with the storm. Like, right. There was a lot of back and forth.
Yeah.
But it was ruled out that she was put in the water prior to her death because of the lack of water in her lungs. It was obvious that she had been in the water.
Yeah.
Because of the damage to her body from the rain, the storm, the salt water. But they did find some grains of sand in her lungs. So that does lead me to believe that she was placed on the beach before passing away.
I would say, like, while she was dying.
Yeah.
Of that terrible blow to her larynx, most likely. I wonder if the killer didn't know if she was dead or not, or truly didn't care, you know, because she probably was in agony, like they were saying, but like maybe she was unconscious. Like, there's a whole bunch of different things like that nobody can really be sure of, but I think you're right, Katie. I think she was on the beach and then ended up in the waters, maybe from the wind, maybe from the tide coming in. It's a whole bunch of different like schools of thought there, but I think she was, you're right, she was dead before she was in the water.
Marion Galvin was known around town as the Purple Lady because she was always decked out in that color. She loved it. It was her favorite. And there's a story about her where at one point she was getting her hair done and she's sitting underneath the big dome hair dryer with her curlers reading a magazine. And then the police officers walked in, pulled up the hair dryer she was sitting under and was like, you need to come down to the station. And she was like, okay, hold on. And she ran next door to this like little boutique, grabbed a purple scarf, tied it up over her rollers, and then went immediately, dropped everything, went down to the station and talked to the police for hours and hours and hours.
Wow.
Hair still in rollers.
Wow.
To help out. She's like, I'm not wasting a second. You need my help. I got to help with the case of this little girl. I'm on it. Say no more.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. And it's funny that you brought up the situation with the tarot cards because Marion herself took statements from several different psychics,
yeah,
one of whom was brought in by Newport police as kind of a last-ditch effort. This psychic said that she could see a pier going out into the water and that Diane's body was dropped off the edge. And Marion said that she thought that, like, anybody could make that guess.
Mm-hmm.
But there were multiple psychics that got involved. Police talked to 27 psychics in total. Between the psychics that they brought in,
mm-hmm.
who like had been used in prior investigations or with other departments,
right.
or psychics who were calling them or showing up
right.
and being like, ooh, I'm a psychic and I think that the car was blue, right. Like psychics that would insert themselves yeah. in the investigation and psychics who were genuinely brought in. But there were 27 in total, which is wild.
Yeah. And you know, the police are getting desperate when they bring in the psychics. That's the last kind of effort that they got.
Yeah.
Always.
And that was big in the 80s, I feel like.
So big in the mm-hmm. 80s. I don't know why. It got them almost always, almost nowhere.
Right. One psychic said that she thought that Diane was walking to work, was offered a ride by a customer who frequented the photo patio, so she felt like she knew him. And then he took her to a place where she had her model or pose for him. Like, me personally, I don't particularly believe in that theory because she was so desperate to get to work and, like, hell-bent on going to work. She was a great kid, great employee, not going to miss a shift. And then she also was not going to miss a shift because it was payday.
Right.
Like we said. So why would she all of a sudden be like, yeah, I'll go model for you.
Right.
And drop everything. And also stranger danger that goes against everything that she would tell her sisters and her friends. Like, don't hitchhike. Right. You know, like, yeah, she might have known this guy, but I really don't think that she would skip out on a shift or not tell anybody where she was going to go and model for some customer. Like, right. I don't. Do I think it's a possibility? Sure, but I don't personally buy it.
Yeah, and this was such a common ruse back then. I mean, there are several famous serial killers and cases where they use this tactic to kill people. And just, I mean, Rodney Alcala is just one of them. Just an example of this. He would pretend he was a photographer, say, hey, you're beautiful. Can I take some pictures? He'd show pictures he's taken before the women before they were dead. And he'd say, look, I can do this to you. I'll give you money. You'll be a star. And they'd be like, well, sure, mister. And then he'd take them there and he'd kill them. And he did. And he was the dating game show killer. And it was like this whole thing. And so I think you're right, Katie. I think she wouldn't have done that. I think the psychic person probably had heard of a story like this before and brought it forward, connecting that she worked at a photo patio and like all this stuff. But considering Diane was smart, considering Diane felt yucky that day, considering that, you know, she wanted to get to work for payday, I just don't think that that's what happened necessarily to her.
A witness who was referred to as Madam X to keep her identity hidden was put under hypnosis and told police that she had passed a young girl who appeared to be hitchhiking on Green End Avenue on the day Diane was last seen. It was cold. It was rainy. The girl had her thumb out. She was trying to get a ride to get out of the rain. And the witness said that she tried to pull over for the girl, but the road was too narrow. So she was able to finally drive forward to a place that she could finally like pull over, turn around, go back the other way. And by the time she circled back, the girl was gone.
Yeah.
So she said this has always bothered her for many years. Like, it always, always sits with her. She always feels like she could have done something. And just the thought that that girl could have been Diane
yeah.
and that she was so close to being the good person that could have offered her a ride. And then she got into another car.
Yeah.
That ultimately led to her death.
Right. It's not her fault.
Not her fault at all. That's just, oh my God, I can't even imagine.
Yeah.
Three people voluntarily went under hypnosis along with Madam X in the span of a single weekend
wow.
to try and provide more information on vague sightings they had had that might be helpful to the investigation. One of the sightings was of a light-colored van seen in the area of Valley Road and Aquidneck Avenue. Another sighting was of a dark green, blue, or black-colored sedan parked in the area of Industrial Park. And the third was of a light-colored sedan in the area of Valley Road and Continental Drive, which are all very close to each other.
Mm-hmm.
Aside from using hypnosis and consulting psychics, police interviewed 14 of Diane's closest friends and acquaintances, spoke with 22 other people who knew Diane, whether they were coworkers or just kind of in the same class as her.
Right.
They also explored leads and spoke with regulars and customers at the photo patio as well. In 2007, a crime analyst with the FBI called the Newport Police Department to ask about Diane's murder. She had been assigned to the case. This case had been followed by the FBI for quite some time, like long before this,
mm-hmm.
but they had reassigned it to this woman. So she's like, all right, let me call them and get the lay of the land. Like, let me become more acquainted with this case.
Yeah.
The crime analyst never got through to a detective the day that she called or any of her following attempts, whether through email, through phone call, because again, it's 2007.
Mm.
A big part of this issue was due to the fact that Rhode Island didn't have their own cold case unit.
Right.
And to my knowledge, they still don't have one, like a designated unit, but they're working on it. And Lauren Malloy, who started Unsolved Rhode Island in honor of her mom, Lori Lee Malloy, who we covered on an episode way back in the day, she has been a huge advocate for Rhode Island getting their own cold case unit so that those cases can get the focus and attention they deserve, while the rest of the department can focus on the incoming and recent cases who they also need to be solved.
Right, right.
So it's like they just don't have the resources.
And I mean, it's Rhode Island. It's small. It's relatively safe. Our friends at the mob tend to keep it as safe as possible, but they can only do so much, you know, protecting their people there. So as safe as the mob keeps them, and we love them for it, it's just they don't have the resources there as a state to solve everything. And I think, you know, Lauren from Unsolved Rhode Island, she's done amazing work. She's a great advocate, not just for her mom's case, but for also many, many cases in Rhode Island and New England, of course. So her trying to get a cold case unit still, I think, is a wonderful idea and a great way to use resources there. And I hope it she keeps fighting that good fight because it's necessary.
For sure.
Yeah.
And Diane's family kind of said the same thing. They said they were very, very appreciative of the police department. They tried their best. You know, they really explored as many avenues as they possibly could. Mm-hmm. I mean, they dealt with 27 psychics.
Yeah.
And they just felt like the police department really was not prepared for a crime of that magnitude, again, with the lack of resources.
Yeah.
But their family was appreciative, and they knew that they were trying their best with what they had.
Yeah. Now, every year, Diane's brother, Bob Drake, holds a memorial on Easton's Beach on the anniversary of Diane's murder. He has this van that's like outfitted with signs and pictures of Diane's face, simply trying to keep attention to her case, to her. A large part of Bob's goal with this pop-up memorial is to change the narrative of Diane's memory. He doesn't really want people to hear her name and necessarily think about the gruesome details of her murder, but think about her legacy and the things she valued most in life. So to us, I mean, at least as far as my understanding, her compassion, her smarts, her friendliness, how much she loved and cared for keeping justice and bringing peace, and just she was such an advocate for everyone she met. And it sounds like he just really wants to keep her memory alive. Bob and several of his siblings are regularly interviewed around the anniversary of her death, and Bob often shares that he won't give up hope, but he is fairly certain there won't ever be a resolution to her murder. He's quoted as saying, "It wouldn't bring much closure for me, because that's the hopelessness of when someone's murdered. They don't come back. What I do want to do is make sure she isn't forgotten, but that's what happened. She was forgotten." And I think, you know, that's obviously very tragic and sad. And I want to say to Bob that she wasn't forgotten because of how hard he's working to keep her memory alive. He's trying so hard, and thanks to him and his siblings, people are still fighting for her, and as they should. The goal for Bob and his family is to have a permanent memorial placed in honor of Diane at Easton's Beach, so it'll be the first thing you see when you arrive, immediately probing interest and also keeping her memory alive.
He said that she's a beautiful person and, quote, would have been the first person to come to me and ask me to forgive whoever done it. He said that his sister always wanted to help people and that he could picture her working as a social worker to protect vulnerable children. One of Diane's sisters, Terry Devine, who also helps get involved with the annual memorials for her, stated, "We were very close, so it was devastating when she passed away for me." Anytime you go on Google, look up Diane Drake, look at these pictures, there are going to be pictures of Bob, the van, Terry with these signs of Diane's name, her picture around where her body was found on the beach.
Mm-hmm.
And like you said, Liz, they do this every year. They try to do it every year. They couldn't March of 2020, of course.
Right.
But, you know, they're still trying to do it every year. And Bob shared in an article I read that one of the last times he saw his sister, she was at the cottage, a little apartment she lived at with Elaine, mm-hmm. and she's working on this puzzle. And the puzzle was of a dove flying and a hawk swooping down with its talons to reach for the dove.
Oh, God.
And she had completed the entire puzzle except for one piece, like right in the middle.
Yeah.
And after her murder, Ba was at the cottage and he was packing up her stuff and he was, you know, putting stuff in boxes, helping his family. And he lifted up the box spring to the bed and he looked down and right between his feet was the missing puzzle piece.
Mm.
And, you know, I work in hospice. I feel like just even if I didn't work in hospice, I'm more of a spiritual person. So I do believe in little signs like that. And I've seen little signs like that firsthand. So I think that was Diane saying hi.
I think so, too.
Mm-hmm.
Especially it being a dove.
Oh, totally.
I don't like the hawk part, but that's an interesting thing to puzzle. Not her puzzling it, but like, why did they make a puzzle out of that?
Right. Maybe like nature.
Yeah.
Like,
it's very bizarre. But I think, you know, the fact that he found that like that beautiful. Definitely a sign.
Bob also wants to keep the memory of Diane alive by starting his own nonprofit organization to help prevent violence against women. And a tentative name for this would be Seven Sisters for, of course, his seven sisters. And he said that all seven of his sisters, like, of course, we know what happened to Diane.
Yeah.
But the six other sisters have all faced some kind of domestic violence at one point in their lives. So he wants to start this nonprofit organization to do something meaningful for Diane.
Yeah.
Kathy stated, it hurts to get your hopes up, but you can't help it. You really want to know. We're convinced she knew who it was because she was smart. She wouldn't have gotten into a stranger's car. Hopefully one of us is still around to get the answers. Somebody knows something, and I'm convinced of that. Roger Williams University has a memorial scholarship in Diane's name that is awarded each year to a graduating senior majoring in administrative justice, which was, of course, Diane's major.
Nice.
Diane has been added to the Rhode Island Cold Case deck of cards, and she is the queen of clubs. Anyone with any information on the murder of Diane Drake is asked to please call the Rhode Island Cold Case Task Force at 1-877-RI-SOLVE. You could also be anonymous and call the anonymous tip line at the Middletown Police Department at 401-842-6516 or their detective line at 401-846-0029.
Wow. And that is the tragic, unsolved murder of Diane Drake, a beautiful soul whose light was burned out way too soon. But her memory lives on through her caring and loving family who pushes forward trying to bring light and attention to her case, which I think is beautiful. I think it's really nice she has such a caring family that does that for her. It's very touching. Guys, we want to know what you think. What are your theories regarding Diane's murder? And if you have any thoughts or any information regarding her murder, if you were there in Rhode Island at that time in March of 1980, or if you know anyone who was in Rhode Island at that time, please contact those numbers that Kate just gave you. You can also send us your thoughts and feelings about this case. You can find us on Instagram at truecrimene,
all lowercase,
or you can send us an email at truecrimene@gmail.com.
We also have a website, truecrimene.com. You could go to our contact page and use our handy-dandy submission tool to leave us your thoughts, questions, comments, concerns, and ideas and case suggestions for other cases based in New England, please. You can be anonymous if you so choose with the website submission tool. You can leave your name if you so choose. And yeah, you can also get creative and leave a review for us with a case suggestion. That's not the second time that that's happened. But again, thank you so much to the person that left that review. You did not leave us your name, but thank you for doing that and bringing this case to our attention. This was not one that we originally had on our list, so we do appreciate you bringing this to us so we can hopefully get it out there in some way, shape, or form, especially as, of course, it is unsolved and her family is still working to keep her name out there.
Absolutely. And with that, we'll see you next week.
Bye.
Goodbye.